Hey guys, welcome to the third episode of Dave the Movie Guy. This is Dave, and we're going to be covering the legendary monster universe today. The three movies we're going to be covering are Godzilla, Kong Skull Island, and Godzilla King of Monsters. We will also be covering the newest movie coming out in November 2020, Godzilla vs. Kong. In a minute, we will have Travis speak on why he's qualified to cover these movies. With this, we're going to jump right in, but I want to remind you that these are our opinions and what we think are important about them. We would like you to watch these movies and form your own opinions. Travis, go ahead.
Hey, I just wanted to say thanks, Dave, for having me on the podcast, my first podcast. I'm qualified basically because I've been watching Godzilla movies since I was a little kid. I'm a big fan of the 90s Godzilla films. They've always been a go-to for me to watch, and I just love them very much, and also, you know, just other movies as well. So thanks for having me.
No problem, Travis, and we are excited to hear what your opinions are on these movies and what you think about them.
Hey.
All right, guys, we're going to jump right in and start with Godzilla. Released in 2014, it was the first movie in the remakes of the Godzilla movies. We open with old Army pictures and films being flashed across the screen. We then see the first A-bomb testing on the island at Biki Atoll. Right before the bomb sets off, we see the back of Godzilla emerging from the ocean. We then cut to the current day with Dr. Ishiro Serizawa of Monarch visiting a mining site which has collapsed, and during the collapse, the miners discovered a cocoon of an unknown creature and saw a hole where a second creature has escaped. We then cut over to Japan, where we see the creature from the hole emerging from the ocean. Now, during all this, when he escaped, he caused seismic activity, which actually weakened the structure of the nuclear power plant. And as he gets closer, the nuclear power plant actually collapses down on itself, and we see the people being evacuated. At this point, we fast forward a few years, and we have Ford Brody, our hero of the movie, returning from his active duty as an EOD officer. That's an ordnance officer for the U.S. Army, who actually is in charge of destroying ordnances, old bombs, things along those lines. Ford heads home and gets a call from Japan, finding out that his father has been detained for trying to return to his old home to recover his data from the original accident. Ford heads to Japan to bail out his dad, and his father talks him into returning to his old home to gather said data. Both being detained this time, we see them being taken to the old nuclear power plant. After they get separated, we see the cocoon of the creature who escaped from the island start pulsating. After this, we see the guys who are watching the cocoon try to fry it with electrical output, which fails and actually causes the cocoon to hatch. After setting off an EMP charge, the Muto is seen, the massive unidentified terrestrial organism. After destroying the base, the Muto flourishes his massive wings and flies away towards America. At this point, we see the second cocoon that was taken by the U.S. Army, which was moved to a nuclear waste storage bunker outside of Las Vegas, Nevada, hatches and actually breaks out of the nuclear base. And it hatches into another Muto. This time it's five times the size of the first, the bigger one being the female.
Yeah, did you notice how the difference in the actual sizes of those new Muto?
Yeah, definitely. The female being considerably larger than the male. But also another feature that is sometimes not noticed is that the female actually does not have wings where the male does, which is why it was convenient that the female was actually already stored in America and the male Muto is actually flying towards America.
Yeah. Remind me of pre-mantises.
Yeah, definitely.
In design. Yeah.
The design and the look of them definitely does kind of remind me of praying mantises. You do have a good point there. So once it hatches, the female Muto starts heading towards Las Vegas, which it actually destroys, and it actually is continuing on its path towards San Francisco. At that point, we cut to Hawaii, where secret forces are tracking a missing nuclear submarine. Once they locate it, they actually find the male Muto, and it is actually pulling a nuclear warhead out of the submarine. With this, we see them trying to take down the male Muto using jets and guns, and none of it's working, of course. And with all that, then we see our main hero, Godzilla, coming into action. Godzilla, being the king of the Titans, is actually in the process of chasing the Muto, and a battle erupts between them. The male Muto escapes and heads towards San Francisco, where the female Muto is building the nest. The male Muto unites with the female, and they fill the nest with eggs of more Mutos and place the nuclear warhead in the nest.
I thought it was fascinating that they actually survived off of nuclear, what was it, radiation that they actually consumed.
Yeah, that's actually a good point, because if we cut back to Japan, the levels were supposed to be too high for people to live in, but Ford and his father actually removed their masks, and there's no nuclear fallout from that. And that's because the male Muto, had actually drained all three of the nuclear reactors dry, feeding on that nuclear radiation.
I thought it was fascinating because it's much different than what Godzilla does. They actually feed off of it. Godzilla basically just absorbs it, or actually just generates nuclear,
Yeah, and
energy.
that actually is that comes up a lot in one of the later movies that we're going to talk about, with Godzilla absorbing nuclear radiation. But yeah, like you said, the Mutos actually do survive off of feeding on it, which is crazy. And I mean, I guess that's why they needed the nuclear warhead for the nest, because their babies are going to come out, and they're going to need food, so.
I just thought it was fascinating that these creatures have been around for billions of years, supposedly, but yet that's what they fed on was that nuclear energy. Like, what did they actually feed on from that time,
Well, I mean, and as a lot of us know, I mean, that stuff's harnessed by nuclear material like uranium and plutonium and stuff like that. And that stuff was prevalent on the planet. I mean, we mine it to make these things happen. So, I mean, I'm not an expert on the Titans, but I definitely see that could be what they were feeding off of
It's
back in the day.
just the levels wouldn't be as strong as like, they would have now, like when man makes nuclear energy.
Yeah,
So it's
definitely.
quite interesting.
Definitely. We then cut to Godzilla swimming towards San Francisco, and he begins to engage in the Mutos. As they continue to fight, Ford and a team of Navy SEALs drops in with a plan to steal the nuclear warhead and lead the creatures out to sea by placing it on a boat and sending the boat out to sea. As they get the bomb out of the hole, though, Ford turns around and sees all the eggs and knows, like, he can tell what havoc these two adults are causing, and actually ends up staying to destroy the eggs because he knows that that would just basically be worst case scenario. So what he does is he actually breaks open a gasoline tanker truck and actually ignites the gas, which actually fries all the Muto eggs.
Reminds me of the of what was it, the early 2000 Zilla movie. Basically the same scene when they're in the arena with all the eggs, and they basically had to get rid of it. It's kind of like, I feel like that's a nod to that, basically.
I'm pretty sure it is. There are a couple nods to some older movies in these newer ones, but yeah, that's definitely pretty much a script-to-script copy of what happened. Except we're not killing Godzilla eggs, we're killing Muto eggs. So after essentially killing all their babies, the Muto gets notices that this is happening and draws all of her attention towards Ford and the Navy SEALs who are sealing this nuclear warhead, and actually starts to give chase. Now, during all this, Godzilla is still directly engaged with the male Muto. And the male Muto actually ends up taking down Godzilla at this point in the movie. Which, I mean, it is a Godzilla movie, so there had to be some struggle.
And I thought it was impressive that that Muto was extremely smaller than Godzilla was at that moment. And still, he was powerful enough to bring Godzilla down. I thought that was fun.
Yeah. Yeah, that definitely was a creative way to play into that. Because it shows, even though Godzilla is the strongest of these titans that we know, he still has his vulnerabilities.
And makes mistakes, yep.
Yeah. So after they take Godzilla down, they proceed to chase the warhead. And then we actually see Godzilla get up and re-engage the Mutos. With this, the battle continues between Godzilla and the male Muto, in which Godzilla, as you're watching the movie, you can see him getting more and more tired. He waits for the Muto to be flying in to attack him, and he actually swings around and hits the Muto with his tail, which sends the Muto into a large building, essentially impaling the Muto. And we see the Muto dying, the blood pouring out of his mouth, which is the traditional movie way to display that someone has died, is blood pouring out of their mouth. And then we cut towards the female Muto, seeing that the male Muto has died, and she decides to come back and also engage with Godzilla. And the way she does this is she actually breaks through a skyscraper in San Francisco and literally drops the building on top of Godzilla. Like, this probably 40-story building just drops on top of him, which essentially knocks him out again. But him being our hero, he of course is knocked out, but he's not done yet. But she takes this as an opportunity to proceed to follow the SEALs and attempts to get the bomb back. Now with this, we see a massive gunfight starting up. We see the Muto literally just killing everybody. All the SEALs are dead. There's only literally one person left in the town, and that's Ford. And he's trying to get this boat started and take this bomb out to sea. Now, of course, as we're doing this and as the boat's starting up, the Muto launches another EMP attack, which fries literally all the systems on the boat. So the boat's just dead in the water.
Yep.
But luckily they were smart enough. They retrofitted a analog clock to the bomb, so the bomb will still go off, but it's not gonna go off anywhere near where they wanted it to, because they wanted it to go off 20 miles outside of the shore so that there would be less of a fallout. But we're talking, he hasn't even made it 10 feet off the 10 feet off the dock at this point. So, at this point, the Muto catches up, the boat's dead in the water, Ford knows that his situation is basically done, the Muto's won. But in some last-ditch soldier mentality, he pulls out his handgun and starts to shoot at the Muto, which, I mean, people are using rocket launchers and ARs and tanks and stuff, and this thing just blinked at him, so I don't know what he figured a pistol was going to do. But what it did do is it did give Godzilla enough time to show up. Now, at this point, remember, we've had Godzilla knocked out twice. Male Muto is dead at this point. Female Muto is completely distracted by getting this bomb back. I'm assuming to lay more eggs and to have the same situation that she had set up before. So Godzilla shows up, and he actually ends up grabbing the female Muto by the neck in his mouth and yanks her back and grabs her by the face. And he actually ends up pulling her mouth apart and using his atomic breath into her throat, which essentially disintegrates her body and separates the body from the head.
Yeah, I love that they actually they made his spikes on his back actually glow right before he started doing his blast, like the original Godzilla's. It was actually it's pretty cool that they did that as well. They went it's good lengths to like bring the old school stuff into the new school.
Yeah, they definitely were trying to respect the source material, unlike the 90s Godzilla movie, which was kind of just like dinosaurs roaming the
Oh
earth.
God.
But
Rocket
they
launchers
definitely,
get taken
yeah,
down.
exactly. But they definitely were a little bit more true to the original Godzilla stories and movies and source material, which was amazing because we don't really see that anymore these days in movies. A lot of times they think, okay, well, we have this old story. We're just going to change it and do whatever we want to do. And it will be our story. But this actually, they took a lot from that original material.
Sure did.
So after he kills the female Muto, he drops her head and proceeds to collapse from exhaustion. Now, I mean, me personally, I don't have atomic breath, but I could assume it could take a lot of effort to use that skill.
It makes sense since he's been dormant for so long, and then all of a sudden have to use that much energy all at once, fighting multiple enemies. You know, and to put that much force into that creature to do the damage that he did,
Right.
you know, I it makes sense.
And then at that point, we see our lovely Godzilla collapse for a third time. This time, they're playing it off in a movie as in he's actually dead. Which, I mean, we can all believe because, I mean, that was just a massive display of power that he just did. But then, after a while, they're doing search and rescue, looking for people who are trapped in buildings and stuff like that. We actually see Godzilla get back up and climb back in the ocean and start heading back towards his home, which we'll discuss in the next movie, the theory behind where these Titans are actually living at and all that and how they get around the planet so quickly. But that's it for Godzilla. We're going to take a break right now, listen to our ad from our sponsor Anchor, then we're going to hop back in and we're going to go to Kong Skull Island. And welcome back, guys. Thank you for listening to our ad from our sponsor, Anchor. And we're going to get right back into it with Kong Skull Island. This movie was released in 2017. We get thrown right into the action with this movie. We see two planes in a dogfight above an island. We see that one of them's a United States fighter and one of them's a Japan fighter. They proceed to actually shoot each other down and land on the beach, probably about 100 feet away from each other, I would say. Both planes exploding, and they end up actually shooting at each other. The American draws his pistol first, shoots like 5 or 6 times, exhausts his clip. And then the Japanese guy pulls out his gun, shoots twice, and then actually proceeds to throw his gun to the side and pulls out a sword. With this, we see the chase scene starting of the Japanese guy chasing after the American guy, in which they eventually caught up, and we end up going into a fist and sword fight, I guess you would call it. And of course, the Japanese guy with the sword gets the upper hand, and we see right as he's pressing the blade into the American soldier. We see a 100-foot ape climb up over the mountain that they're fighting, and we get introduced to Kong.
You know, the visual on that was actually spectacular. They did a fantastic job with that. That actual scene was very, very artistically well done. And, you know, you could literally take a picture of it and frame it. It would look that good.
Yeah, definitely. And they actually captured the intensity of the battle between these two soldiers too, which was awesome because normally you could kind of tell that it's a scripted fight, but this time it was able to be like a true fight. It would be like if you and I were fist fighting each other and one of us had a sword.
Definitely captured that World War II feel and desperate, like, battle to win.
So after all this, Kong comes up. We see Kong for the first time. And then we're thrown right into Washington, D.C. at the end of the Vietnam War. We see an early version of the Monarch Organization trying to get funding for a new expedition to an uncharted island called Skull Island, hence the movie title Kong Skull Island. We join them as they head to a senator's office, and we see the secretary attempting to reschedule the meeting again for the fifth time. Clearly, this senator was trying to avoid them. We find out later that he actually doesn't believe in what they're doing. So he kind of references what kind of a monster are you chasing this time? As they're sitting there, they're talking with the secretary. The senator actually comes out and agrees to listen to them for 5 minutes, in which they explain that there's already a manned mission going to the island and that they would just like to tag along with it. When he asks why, they say that they're looking for all kinds of different things. Cure, they could possibly find a cure, cancer, they could find minerals, all kinds of stuff.
Unknown species.
Unknown species. Basically, big at this time, the Cold War was heating up, so it would be big wins for the United States if they found these things. He does actually surprisingly approve the mission. And Randar, which is the main guy from Monarch, tells him that they would need a military escort. Now, the reason why I bring this up is this is actually an introduction of one of my favorite actors in the movie. We actually cut to a military base where soldiers are being packed up and being shipped home from Vietnam. We meet General Packard, who is played by Samuel L. Jackson. And as they're celebrating, they're leaving the base, getting ready to go home. Packard gets a call asking him to do one more mission, which he agrees to. With that, we cut to Randa again heading to essentially recruit a third person or another person for this mission. So we see him heading to a bar with Brooks, his assistant, to hire what they're calling a tracker, an expert tracker. We then meet Conrad, an ex-British Secret Service member who agrees to guide him through the jungle for a hefty price. We cut to them loading the boat for the Landsat mission, which is the group that actually discovered the island. And we see the team arriving with Conrad, Packard, the guys from Landsat, all the scientists, Randa and Brooks. As well as a photographer, we see them all boarding this boat. We cut to a few more minutes of them sailing. Everybody, the photographers taking pictures of all the soldiers. They're investigating the ship. And we see Conrad actually breaking into the bows of the ship where he sees seismic charge and munitions. Which kind of raised a question, what were they thinking that they were going to run into on this island? Because it's supposedly it's an undiscovered island, but they felt worried enough to have this ship literally filled with weapons.
Extreme firepower.
So we cut back to Randa, Packard, the main scientist from Landsat, and the captain of the ship standing in the bridge of the ship, where the captain tells them that he cannot get any closer to the island. This prompts the Landsat guy to get really worried because there is actually a perpetual thunderstorm, a never-ending thunderstorm, kind of looks like a hurricane from satellite imaging, surrounding this island.
Extremely ominous.
Yeah, the way it looks in the movie is spectacular
So good.
because all you see is you literally just see swirling clouds with lightning going off behind them, which, I mean, it was filmed very well. The guy from Landsat tries to cancel the mission. Randall looks at him and says, "Are you really going to cancel this mission on account of rain?" Playing homage to baseball, which comes in a little bit later in the movie. We then see Randall look at Packard and tells him that it's his call if they go ahead. And Packard, being the general that he is, did not want to go back home. So he agrees to fly this mission into this storm. We cut ahead to everybody getting on the helicopters. The Landsat guy at one point said that he wasn't going to get on it, but we see him climbing on the helicopter too, kind of shooting his credibility right away. And then we see the helicopters taking off. At this point, we hit a very pivotal moment in the movie because we see the helicopters approaching the wall of the storm, and Packard gets on the radio to all of his helicopters and references the story of Icarus from the Bible about how his father made him wings of wax and told him not to fly too close to the sun. But he couldn't accept, he couldn't resist the temptation to do so. And he ended up falling to the earth. Packard guarantees everybody that the pure Pennsylvania steel that was mined to build those helicopters could handle anything, and the US government is an irresponsible father of sorts. We see them go into the storm, gets really rough. Warning lights are flying off on all the helicopters. But then they cross out of the storm, and it's like it never happened. It's a beautiful sunny day. Everybody's there. No helicopters went down. Once they break through, Packard directs the choppers to split up and head into their areas. The first group is to drop the Landsat team off and help them set up a base of operations and start surveying the land. The next group is to drop the seismic charges around the island, helping them do so. And the third group is just investigating the terrain. So we see them dropping these seismic charges, and out of nowhere, we see a tree fly through the windshield of one of the helicopters. We don't know where the tree came from. All of a sudden, we're looking, and there's a tree flying at the screen. Of course, this helicopter crashes, and then literally all hell breaks loose. We cut to Packard, Randa, Conrad, and all the other main characters getting her first look at Kong. We see one of the soldiers who sees Kong look at the window and say, "Is that a big monkey?" Clearly not referencing the importance of what they're looking at. We at this point, Packard gives the order to kill Kong with everything that they had. But with this, Kong retaliates, destroying all the helicopters in the air. And then actually going as far as destroying the helicopters that landed to drop Landsat off and killing a lot of the soldiers. We cut to Packard's helicopter being knocked out the air. Packard survives. He gets out of the helicopter, goes back to rescue one of his men. His helicopter explodes as well. We then cut to Packard gathering up whatever soldiers he could find, and he runs into Randa with two of his other soldiers. And with that, he pulls out a gun and proceeds to interrogate Randa on what he knows about what they just experienced. Clearly, an untraditional experience. Not very often you see a 100-foot monkey throwing trees and killing all your friends.
On an uncharted island as well.
Yeah,
No
definitely.
one's been to, supposedly.
Randa cuts through, explaining that monsters do exist, and he goes on to explain the Hollow Earth theory, which is a theory I referenced in the first movie, with how these monsters survive in the Earth and how they get around so quickly. We then see Conrad gathering up survivors as well, and they start moving along the river because they know that the river leads to the exfil site where they're supposed to be getting picked up by more helicopters. During this, they actually end up running into our old friend from World War II, Marla, the American soldier who got shot down. And we also see them run into the rest of the population of the island, which apparently had indigenous people on it before Marla arrived. They all travel to the island with, or they all travel to the village with them, where he explains the story of Kong and the Skull Crawlers. Now, this is important because we see our first look at the villain of the movie. It's not the actual creature, but we see paintings from the locals.
Yes. Also a very visual scene as well. Very, very well done. Especially the way they did it, they painted it in a certain way in the rocks, and you have to be a certain angle to see the image. And it's fun to see.
He then warned where Kong, why Kong attacked them, and he warns them that they were going to wake up the big skull crawler, which is the main antagonist of the story, the main bad guy.
Very scary creatures.
Yeah, they.
They're pretty wild. I wish I could see more of them throughout different movies,
Yeah.
but I know they're indigenous to that
Well,
island.
I mean, there might be a revisit of them coming up. We'll get to that in a little bit. He then shows them a boat that him and the Japanese soldier have actually been attempting to build out of their old airplanes that crashed, and said that he couldn't get it up and running before the Japanese soldier died, but with their help, they could get it up and running. They do. They start sailing down towards the expo site, where they run into Packard and the other soldiers. He tells Conrad that they have to go inland to get one of their soldiers that was left after he got shot down. So we cut to them walking through this field. And this is not a good field. This is not a pretty field. It's filled with bones.
Death everywhere.
Marlowe actually references it as the death fields, and he tells them that this is where Kong's parents made their final stand, and that they were killed by the big skull crawler, and that Kong was actually still just a baby, and he's still growing. At this point, we see it's not our very first introduction, but it's our first real battle with the Skull Crawlers, where they discover that they're in the death fields. They go through an intense battle with some poisonous gas. Some stuff gets ignited. There's lots of flames. There's these weird bird things that Conrad ends up chopping up with swords as he's trying to get to one of the other guys. And as all this is going on, we see one of the skull crusher or skull crawlers hack up a skull of a person. This person is the guy that Packard was supposedly going to rescue. So after they defeat the skull crawlers, Conrad takes a dog tag, shows him to Packard, and Packard is like, it doesn't matter, we're going to continue. Conrad's says there's no point to continue. He's dead. There's nobody else. We need to get back to the boat. We need to get off this island. Then we see Packard revealing his true colors. And that is his plan to actually kill Kong. And when Marla protests, Packard turns around and says, "We'll kill him and then we'll kill these other things too." They need to understand that man's at the top of the food chain. Which, if he had seen anything that happened with Godzilla, which happens actually in the future, he would clearly understand that man is not anywhere near the top of the food chain.
Not at all.
So Packard takes the troops to go get the munitions, and Conrad takes all the other survivors with him. They go back to the boat, and Conrad. And Packard goes to the helicopter to get all the munitions. At this point, we see the divide happening between everybody. Conrad, the photographer, and Marlowe decide that they're going to stand up to Packard and stop him from killing Kong. So we cut back to Packard. He's setting up his trap. We see them setting some of the seismic charges in the ground. We see them pouring napalm over this giant lake. And then Packard gives the order to start setting everything off. With that, we see the munitions, the seismic charges going off, which attracts Kong. When he gets in the water, Packard springs the trap, sets the water on fire. This actually severely wounds Kong to the point where Kong does try to fight back. He knocks some of the napalm out of the water on some of the troops, but he eventually ends up succumbing to his wounds and collapsing in front of Packard and the other troops. This is when Packard gives the order to put demolition charges on Kong directly. Marlowe, Conrad, and the photographer show up and actually end up pulling swords and guns on everybody and getting the soldiers to agree not to kill Kong. And right when all this is going on, the warnings come true and the big skull crawler comes out of the ground. So with this, we see all the soldiers running away except for Packard, who decides he's going to stay and prove his point to everybody. I
could see his point of wanting to destroy them all because of how much of a threat they are. But I think his attitude, like his wanting to be right was just too much.
Right, but he wanted to kill them all because he was threatened by him, but he knew nothing about him. Kong was actually the defender of this island. He kept these people safe. But when he was told that, he didn't care because he could not accept the fact that he was incorrect.
Yeah.
This thing was a threat. It killed his men, so now he's going to kill it.
True.
So we cut back to the movie, and we see Packard getting ready to turn on the demolition charges, and right when he goes to hit the button, Kong decides that he's done with him and ends up actually just slamming his fist down on him and killing him instantly.
Crushing him flat as a pancake.
And then we see Kong getting up, still wounded, and he starts to engage the large skull crawler because, like I said, he's the defender of this island. He defends the people. So when this thing comes up, he sees these people running away. His first instinct is to defend them. With that, though, Kong starts to get beat down by the skull crawler. Like, this thing is, like, biting him, tearing him up, throwing him around, whipping him with the tail.
It's a great battle. Loved watching that.
It's an amazing battle. But it does leave, like, the previous movie, it leaves our hero defeated. Mm-hmm. Pinned down between some propellers of a boat in some chains. So then we see one of our soldiers deciding that he's going to try and help everybody out. So he's waiting with some grenade pins that have already been pulled. He tries to throw them at it, but right before he could throw it, the skull crawler smacks him with the tail, sends him in, big explosion, he dies.
Yeah, they,
very actually sad moment. I really like that.
Very. I was impressed on how smart the skull crawlers were. Especially the one that was the lead one. It was fun. I liked it.
So with that, we cut to everybody. They find the boat. They get on the boat. They decide to start attacking the large skull crawler to give to try and take his attention off of Kong. Kong gets up and ends up actually breaking. This is actually a pretty impressive part. He ends up breaking the propellers off the boat using the chains as essentially whips.
Yep.
And ends up throwing these propellers at the skull crawler as he's beating him senseless with them. Now, I mean, of course, the skull crawler doesn't give up. He comes back, starts attacking Kong again. But then we see Kong take the big rusty propeller and actually jam it into the skull crawler's body, killing the skull crawler. We cut to the boat where we see them leaving the island on the boat. They all turn around. They see Kong standing there. Kong's watching them leaving, essentially completing his duty of making sure that they're safe. At this point, we kind of get a little jumbled up the timeline, because we cut to Conrad and the photographer locked in an interrogation room at this point. We don't know how long it's been since the island. We don't know why they're locked in the room. We just know that they're in the room. They're saying that they didn't see anything, yada, 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 so on and so forth. And then who but anybody enters the room but Brooks from the island. And he welcomes them to Monarch. And then just as a little bit of a kickback, we see Marlo returning home, being united with his wife and son after many years of disappearance. And Marlo's big thing is that he wanted to have a hot dog while watching the Cubs opening day at Fenway Park while drinking a beer. And we see him in his home with his beer and his hot dog watching the Cubs opening game on his TV. So that's not really important to the storyline, but it was a good sum up for his character.
It was heartfelt. It was good to see that character actually be able to have a happy ending.
Right, yeah, especially after so many years of rough living, we'll call it.
What an adventure, though, of a life. You know, that would be a wild way to live.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. All right, guys, we're going to hop right into King of Monsters. This movie was just recently released in 2019, and we join Dr. Emma Russell and her daughter at a top-secret Monarch base. In this base, we see there's a titan in a cocoon sac about to hatch. As they're standing there, the titan does hatch, and it is referenced that it is Mothra.
And I thought it was a good touch that they actually bring the original Mothra theme song into that. It's very vague, but you can hear it. It was so good to hear that, because it referenced when I was a child and watching the originals. I loved it so much.
Yeah, that's going back to them trying to tie in the original source material back to the new products as well. But then we, like I said, we see Mothra hatching. They reference that it's Mothra. And being agitated because it's in this containment field, Mothra begins to retaliate, I guess would be the best way to cover it, in which prompts the soldiers who were guarding it to shoot at Mothra. Now, this, of course, irritates Mothra even more because you were just born and now suddenly people are shooting at you. Dr. Russell runs out with an invention of her own design named the Orca. This machine's job is to echo the noises made by Titan Alphas. And at this point, the only Titan Alpha that we know of at this current moment is Godzilla. With this, she's able to calm Mothra down until a terrorist organization breaks into the lab and abducts her, her daughter, and the machine. After this happens, we see Mothra escape and head to a waterfall where she is re-cocooned to enter her final stage. At this point, we see Brooks come back from Kong Skull Island, and he is sent to what they are calling the waterfall is Castle Bravo site to monitor the activity. We cut to Dr. Serizawa and Dr. Graham from the Godzilla movies in a courtroom where they're being interrogated about the Godzilla situation, and they're asking them questions like, how many of these things are there? What do we know about them? They're basically trying to make the decision, good or bad, should we just destroy these creatures? Mm-hmm. After this, in the middle of the court hearings, Dr. Serizawa gets a text message in which him and Dr. Graham and their lawyer all leave because they got word of the abduction of Dr. Russell, in which they then get on a plane, fly to where her ex-husband is located, and they tell him of the situation and recruit him to assist with helping find his wife and daughter. Dr. Russell is taken to another Monarch base, this time in Antarctica, where they are storing what they're calling Monster Zero. Not very much is known about this monster. It's not like the other ones that we see in Cocoons, which hatch, or Godzilla that's been known about for years. This is literally just a monster that we see encased in ice in Antarctica.
Of course, it does have a familiar figure throughout the ice.
Yeah, if you're a Godzilla fan and you see that figure, you kind of know where we're where they're going with it. But if you're new to the whole thing, then, I mean, they cover that here in a few minutes. But the group intends to actually awaken Monster Zero. Now, at this point, we're giving reference to the fact that Monster Zero is another Alpha Titan. There would be no other point to waking him except for that. Godzilla, hearing the frequency from the orca, begins to head towards Antarctica with Monarch close at chase. We then cut to Antarctica, where we show Monarch showing up right as they are literally getting ready to hit the button to release Monster Zero. The aftermath is that Monster Zero is awoken, because many Monarch agents, as well as Dr. Graham, who again was with us through our previous movies. Godzilla then arrives and begins to battle with Monster Zero before it escapes. Again, they always got to escape the first time. The Monarch group finds out that Dr. Russell is actually working for the terrorists from a message that she sends from a Monarch base in Boston. Dr. Russell contacts Monarch and argues that the Titans must be woken up to reverse the damage that the humans have created. Then we see Dr. Russell and the terrorist group head to Mexico, where they wake Rodan. Monarch decides to lead Rodan directly towards Monster Zero, which starts a conflict between the two. Rodan is quickly defeated by Monster Zero, and Godzilla shows up to continue the battle. After an ambush of Godzilla, because Godzilla's in the water, he springs up, kind of like a jack-in-the-box. He's like, hey, I'm here. He actually springs up and ends up severing the left head of Monster Zero. Monster Zero at this point is awakened, so we know that he has three heads. Godzilla removes the third head. The Navy, in their infinite wisdom, decides to launch a prototype missile called the Oxygen Destroyer.
Hence, to the one of the original movies with the Oxygen Destroyer. They actually used that in a previous movie.
Okay. This seemingly kills Godzilla, but does not do anything to Monster Zero. Showing that Monster Zero is not a creature to be trifled with.
They actually said that he's not from this Earth.
Right.
Hence why he didn't get affected.
Yeah, so, I mean, clearly they're referencing the point that he doesn't need oxygen to survive. Mm. Hence, he's not from this Earth. After all this goes down, Monster Zero regrows his left head and awakens all the other Titans using his alpha frequency around the world, and makes Rodan submit to his will.
The scene when he did that, when he did his roar and overtop the completely destroyed city, when his wings spread out and electric went everywhere, it was phenomenal. It was a great image. I know I keep going back to that, but I mean, it was.
Well, what you're showing is how visually important the directors knew that these certain scenes are going to be. We have actually had the same producers and the same writers and a couple different directors, but they worked with each other on the films, proceed through the film. So, I mean, we're getting the same movie quality through each film, which is why you keep on bringing up how quality the visuals are.
The actual, like, intensity of the construction, or the basically the disaster of these Titans, it's just so mass. Like, it's just a wild movie to see just the destruction of everything. They really bring that essence to you. Like,
yeah, they definitely, the destruction scenes are amazing. But then we cut to Monarch having a meeting where, like I said, if you're an old Godzilla fan, you know the reference. But Monster Zero's name was discovered to be King Ghidorah. He is seeking to transform our world to his liking. So then we cut out of there, and we have Mothra emerging from her cocoon, and Godzilla is wounded at this point in his home, and Mothra begins to communicate with Godzilla. Tracking Godzilla, Monarch finds Godzilla in a part of the world known as the Hollow Earth, referencing the previous two movies. We then cut to Dr. Serizawa getting in a submarine, a smaller submarine that's launched from the main submarine, and we see him driving a submarine to Godzilla. When he arrives, we see him getting out of the submarine and bringing a nuclear weapon with him, which then he sets off sacrificing himself, but then reviving Godzilla.
That all did play, take place in an ancient civilization that worshipped Godzilla, which I thought was super cool. And if you notice, when he gets out of the small submarine and he walks up the steps, you can actually see it's much like Egypt style statues of men with Godzilla heads, and how much they actually like worship this creature. You really gotta like keep an eye out to see all the fine details. It's awesome.
And something else that I found was very important is right before the bomb detonates, of course they're in this hollow earth, which is filled with radiation. Serizawa knows that he's not going to survive, so he actually ends up removing his helmet that was keeping him safe. Well, it wasn't keeping him safe, it was just limiting the time. But we see Serizawa and Godzilla almost bonding on an emotional level with each other. We see Serizawa looking into Godzilla's eyes. We see him walk up the stairs, puts his hand on his face. This is the monster that he's been studying his whole life. And we finally get to see that come full circle when he actually gets to be in the area with him, which I felt was a very important part of the movie, because it shows that we as humans can coincide with these creatures.
The emotion that you could see in Godzilla's eye with him standing there was it was very well
Well,
done.
because, I mean, Godzilla, I'm sure, also knew, because, I mean, in the previous movies, we see Godzilla and Serizawa seeing each other on multiple occasions. So, I mean, this is the guy who's been chasing him for years, studying him. At one point in the movie, he actually references that humans become Godzilla's pets, because Godzilla is this alpha titan that could keep us safe. We then cut back to the terrorist organization, where we see Dr. Russell discovering the damage that the Titans are causing and realizing that it's more than mankind can cause, and begs the terrorists to allow her to stop this. But Dr. Russell's daughter overhears the whole thing and escapes, stealing the orca, and heads to Fenway Park. Now, again, the reference, they are in Boston. So Fenway Park was not too far from where they were. But the daughter has this grand idea that she's going to make this right. But we see the daughter arrive at Fenway Park and, not knowing how to use the orca, instead of calling Godzilla, which she was originally trying to do, she actually ends up calling all the Titans to her location. Now, why this is important is because at this point we saw about 30 to 40 Titans coming out of their various areas, and now they're all converging onto this one area on the globe in Boston, of all places.
There's a scene where they're arguing amongst each other at the one of the bases, and if you look at the computer screens all in the background, you could see all different kinds of stuff referencing and showing different monsters, and some of the monsters that you don't even get to see in the movie. So that's a good thing to go, click through and see image by image.
Well, like I said, she doesn't know how to use this machine, and she called all the Titans to her location. And who arrives first but our main baddie, Ghidorah? And he arrives in Boston to actually destroy the Orca, because he knows that this machine can call all these other and can give him a fight for power. So Ghidorah arrives in Boston to destroy it, and shortly after that, Godzilla arrives with Monarch close at tail. Godzilla's radiation level starts to rise. He's gaining power. So the Monarch team, realizing that this is happening, they decide that they have to flee the city because, I mean, this is a giant creature. It's beginning to glow red. It's gaining power, and they don't know what's going on. At this point, he's gaining power from all the nuclear radiation that he absorbed. Then we see Mothra coming back into the picture. Mothra attempts to fly in to help Godzilla with the battle against Ghidorah, but Rodan comes in and decides that he's going to fight Mothra as Godzilla's fighting Rodan. Mm-hmm. Or Godzilla's fighting Ghidorah as Mothra's fighting Rodan. Now, as Godzilla is the king of the Titans, Mothra is considered the queen. So Mothra disposes of Rodan, and in a last-ditch effort to help Godzilla, she actually ends up giving Godzilla all of her power. Ghidorah overpowers Godzilla, and like Mothra gives him her power literally right as he's about to give the final blow to Godzilla. And at this point, Dr. Russell turns back on to Orca, which attracts Ghidorah and gives Godzilla some chance to essentially power up, heal himself.
Yeah. Because he does have a continuous healing factor, basically. Godzilla can be bombarded with all kinds of, like, bombs, missiles, everything, and it just as soon as it happens, it basically reheals. Basically, you know, from the 90s movies, that's what he would be able to do since he's such a powerful creature. So his regenerative abilities are very impressive.
At this point, Godzilla enters a whole new power level that nobody has ever seen. He starts glowing red, and everything around him starts to melt. We're talking metals melting. We're talking literally everything melts. At this point, he is easily strong enough to kill Ghidorah. And they ensue in battle, which is actually a very short battle because he is as powerful as he is. And after defeating him, Godzilla actually reverts back to his normal power, his original power level. And at this point, he then roars, which shows Rodan and all the other Titans that he is this Alpha Titan. He is the best of the best. And Rodan, as well as all the other Titans, arrive and bow to him. I think in the movie we see probably about 10 Titans bowing towards Godzilla.
The ones that could at least get to him.
Right. Because, I mean, you got to remember, these guys are all across the world. They're in everything. So, I mean, they move quickly, but not all of them move that quickly.
Yep.
At the end of the credits, we do see a cutscene, which is actually a pretty important cutscene, and it leads us into the next movie. We see news clippings from Monarch showing that the Titans are actually healing the planet, and that they're co-signing with the humans, which was the big fear all along. And then we cut to a second egg, which is referenced to possibly be another Mothra egg. At this point, we see the Titans kind of splitting up into two different groups. We see some of the Titans are converging on Skull Island, where Kong was at. And then the rest of the Titans are hanging around where Godzilla is, essentially. We cut to Monarch reviewing some cave paintings. And in those cave paintings, we actually see a very interesting picture, which actually leads us to our fourth movie. It's of Godzilla and Kong fighting each other. And then just as one final cutscene, we see the terrorist in Mexico purchasing Ghidorah's severed left head. What this means, they didn't really clarify, but it's sure to tie into the next movie.
I hope that they do Mecha King Ghidorah.
That would be interesting. Mecha, the Mecha creatures are definitely...
Yeah, I've always had a love for them. I also love the big giant spaceships and the jets and everything, which they referenced with, you know, what was it, Monarch, you said?
Yeah.
So, it's the nod to all of that was really great. I loved it. But yeah, it's hopefully going to be a good movie.
Yeah, all right. All right, guys, and finally, we're going to be talking about Godzilla versus Kong. This is one of my most anticipated movies coming out in 2020. It is coming out in November, so it's an end-of-the-year movie, which, if I remember correctly, they have traditionally launched these movies towards the end of the year. But what we know at the moment is not much. We can assume some things from the title, but what we know at the moment is... it's the basics that the studio is giving us, which is when monsters walk the earth, humanity fights for its future, puts Godzilla and Kong in a collision course that we see the two most powerful forces in nature on the planet collide in a spectacular battle for the ages. Monarch embarks on a mission into uncharted terrain and unearths clues to the Titan's origins. A human conspiracy threatens to wipe out the creatures, both good and bad, from the face of the planet. Now, that is directly from the studio. Now, what I'm thinking we're going to see references of is, of course, we are going to see a grand fight between Godzilla and Kong at some point. I don't think this is going to be one of those movies where they reference that it's going to be a fight and then they just end up not fighting. We are going to see an epic showdown between the two. But we're going to start seeing a few things here. First, the humans and the conspiracy to destroy him. I think that's back to our terrorist friends that just purchased Ghidorah's head. We also see reference in the previous movie with the Titans beginning to kind of split up into factions. Like I said during the last bit, is that some of them were heading towards Skull Island, some of them were heading towards Godzilla's base of operations. What we also can make a pretty good indication is that Monarch is going to be directly on the front lines of this battle, either causing it or trying to make it not happen. Either way, they are going to be in the middle of it. We're hoping that we're going to see some of our favorite people come back on this movie. But, I mean, we do see Titans healing the planet from the last one. The talk of a second Mothra egg is actually is going to play a big part into this movie, I think, because we're going to reintroduce Mothra back into the fold. Now, with this, we don't know what role she's going to play in this next movie, but we do know that, like I stated in the last bit, that Godzilla is considered the king, she's considered the queen. So, and we do know that they have a connection to the point where they could communicate with each other, as well as that they could transfer power to each other. So, that's all I have on that. What do you think about that?
Well, I'm not sure. I'm thinking more that Godzilla and King Kong will actually fight, like you said, but and Mothra will probably play a role in that, but I think there's going to be a much bigger threat, because with the source material of all the other movies they can use from that, you know, it could be a possible... multiple possible things of any other creature that could come.
Well, I mean, besides Ghidorah, who else is as big of a threat as Godzilla, Mothra, and Kong? Because, I mean, we already saw Mothra disband Rodan, so he clearly isn't a threat. The other Titans bowed to Godzilla already, so, I mean, what are you thinking, idea-wise, what else could be this massive threat?
Space Godzilla.
So are we talking Mecha Godzilla? Nope. Or are we talking a whole other Godzilla from outer space?
There's, from the old series movies, there's a part of DNA from Godzilla that got jettisoned into space. I can't remember which monster did it, but once it went into space, it went into a black hole and developed into Space Godzilla, which actually wanted to come back to Earth and challenge Godzilla. If you go back and watch that movie, it's actually a really good one. You know, Space Gods versus, you know, regular Godzilla. It's really good. He's a very, very powerful creature. And if they bring him into this series, he would probably be the most powerful creature to battle.
So are you thinking we're going to have a battle between Godzilla and Kong, and then they're going to team up to fight this unknown force?
Kong, Godzilla, and Mothra versus...
whatever this unknown.
Whatever unknown. I'm hoping it's Space Godzilla, because I'm a big fan of Space Godzilla. It could be other ones. There is other monsters that came from space.
Well, there's that too, but then we also refer back to the previous movie where the terrorists are buying the head of Ghidorah.
True.
And we don't know what their plans are on that. They could be, for all we know, they could be genetically engineering a new Ghidorah.
They could be. It could be Mecha King Ghidorah.
Or it could be Mecha King Ghidorah, yeah, or it so. Could be any variety of different Titan.
Yeah.
But all we do know for a fact is that this is going to be one that we're going to keep a close eye on as more details come out, because if it's anything like the previous movies, it's going to be, like Travis kept on referencing, it's going to be an incredible cinematic view. There's going to be intense scenes. In all actuality, the scripts in all three of the movies that have came out so far have been not bad. They haven't been the best scripts, but they have, trust me, there's been a lot worse out there.
Yeah, I'm not opposed to seeing the human side of the movie, but I love seeing the Titan side more so than the human side. Sometimes it can get boring, but I mean, I think they did a good job.
Yeah, they definitely did, and I mean, you do make a good point there, because, I mean, what Godzilla and Kong, we saw more of the human aspect of the battles and what they could cause. But with King of Monsters, we actually got to see the majority of the movie was these titans fighting each other. Mm-hmm. And how intense these battles could be and how strong these creatures actually are. And to go back to King of Monsters, when Sarazawa references that we should become Godzilla's pets... if these things were real and this was actually going on, I would not mind being Godzilla's pet. Because clearly he's one of the most badass creatures out there right now. So, I mean, like he said, we can't wait to see what this fourth movie's bringing to the fold. Okay, there you guys have it. I would like to give a special thanks to our guest co-host, Travis, who took time out of his day to sit down with me. I want him to sit down because literally he is one of the most knowledgeable Godzilla fans I know. As he referenced in many of the movie or in many of the sections, he has seen plenty of the older movies, a lot more than I have. Between the movies that I have seen and the movies that are coming out now, I am a bit of a bigger fan of the movies that are coming out now, but that's just because we're getting more of our current technology put into those, so we're getting a lot more realistic stuff. But with that, we covered everything from Godzilla fighting Mutos, to Kong fighting Skullcrawlers, to Godzilla and Mothra fighting Ghidorah and Rodan, and to even our favorite heroes, Godzilla and Kong, fighting each other. We talked about how these creatures were found, how they fought, and what they did. We hope that you now have a little bit better of an understanding about how all three of these movies are connected and how they play into the fourth one. We would like to thank you guys again. And in our next episode, we will be covering the Dark Knight trilogy from Christopher Nolan. And we will be going over how all these movies play together, not just as characters, but how the stories build on each other. Remember, don't let anybody tell you what's good or not. Just watch what you want to watch. Please visit our Facebook page or Twitter page, Dave Talks Movies. There you can see trailers for the movies that we've been talking about, as well as our newest episodes, as well as trailers for upcoming movies that we're going to be talking about. Also, subscribe to either our Spotify, Google Podcasts, Radio Public, Breaker, or Anchor pages. There you'll get our newest podcasts as soon as they come out. If there's a movie or a series of movies you want us to talk about, leave us a comment on either page and we will get to it. Also, hit us up with your ideas and thoughts about the topics we've been talking about. I will respond to all your comments on both pages. This is Dave the Movie Guy signing out.